This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The Ribbono Shel Olam wished to benefit Israel, and therefore he gave them a large amount of Torah and Mitzvot. One needs to appreciate the value of that comment of Chazal. On the surface it would appear that the more Torah and Mitzvot the Ribbono Shel Olam gives us, the more opportunity for our veilers there are. The more opportunity there is to do things wrong. In a sense, we would have been better off had he given us a smaller Torah and less mitzvahs, it would have been less responsibility. And yet we see that that isn't so. But it's a schus, it's our privilege, it's our benefit that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave this amount of Torah, gave large quantities of Torah and mitzvahs. We need to understand why it is so much to ask this, and what would have been so terrible had the Torah been a little bit smaller and the mitzvah a little fewer. And in so doing, I'm going to take last night's shiur a little further, which is going to require me to repeat some of the basics of last night's shiur, which I don't mind doing. Firstly, because there are many people here who weren't there last night, and secondly, there are many people who were there last night and they weren't there as well, and also needed. And thirdly, even those who were, a bit of chazorah won't do any harm. The context is difficult. But perhaps, in fact, I should apologize not to those who were there last night, but to those who weren't. Those who weren't there last night will understand it. Those who were there last night will understand it tonight. Those who weren't there last night will find it difficult tonight. It started with a very difficult rashi. Where the Ribbono Shel Olam says, after Odom HaRishon and Chava are speaking from the Eitz Hadas, Hein ha'odom hoyot ke'achad minenu, lo das chivro. Behold, Odom has become like one of us, to know good and bad. The Ato and now can mishpach yodoi velotach gan le'eitz ha'chaim, ve'ochal v'chaim lo'i lo. He has to put out his hand and take also from the tree of life and he will live forever. There are two rashes. The first one, what does it mean, hoyot ke'achad minenu? Arehu yochid b'tachtoim. He is unique among the creations of the lower world. Just as I am unique in the higher world. And what is the uniqueness of man? If he now knows how to, he knows Tzoyvara, he knows good and bad, whatever that means. Learn and analyze and figure what he doesn't mean. Mashen can be the hymn of the chayah, the animals haven't got this truth. The ato and now, this being the case, can mishlach yodo, you mishiyichle, yiloilo mare yukolim lahati yisadu yisachle. And this being the case, if he will live forever, he will be close to misleading the creation after him, the loyomar afu eloya, claiming that he too is a god. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam is worried. That Odom HaRishon now has the capacity to mislead the Bria, treating him like a god as well, to believe that he is a god. And we asked last night, what is the Ribbono Shel Olam worried about? Before the chet, Odom HaRishon was to live forever. And he certainly had no less knowledge than he had after the chet. He was much greater before the chet than he was after the chet. So if before the chet, the Ribbono Shel Olam was not worried that he would mislead the Bria, since he had all that, he was even greater and he was eternal. Now that he's not as great, what's the shiner? Why shouldn't he be? Why should he mislead the Bria more now than he could have before? What was that question last night? the answer to the principles the Rambam introduces us to in the beginning of the Murray Nebuchadnezzar in the second period. And the Rambam says that there are two different terms that we use. The one term that we use is emes v'sheker, truth and falsehood. And there is another term which we use, which is tov v'ra, good and bad. But we use them to describe completely different situations. Firstly, there is the situation which the Rambam calls the mustolos, the situation of conflict. And then there is the situation of mustolos, which we translated, and I think it's the most accurate translation of mustolos, is appearances, things as they appear. When you're dealing with concepts, the term to value, the term to use when valuing the concept is emes v'sheker. It's true or it's false, that's all that's important. Whether you like the concept or you don't like the concept is not important. Is it true or is it false? However, when you're valuing mefusolos, when you're valuing appearances, and you're not interested in whether it's true or it's false. In any case, you're looking at what you see. That's all you have to judge. You're not analyzing. You're looking at what's in front of you. So what's important is what you feel about it. What response does it arouse in you? And for that we use the term it arouses a good response in me or it arouses a bad response in me. Might be different for you. I like it. I find it pleasing. You might find it unpleasing. It doesn't matter. And that's why different people like different things. Appearances have no objective standard. When you're looking at appearances, it's a matter of taste, it's a matter of what it happens to arouse in you. When you're looking at truth and falsehood, there are objective standards, the basis on which one can establish the truth or the falsehood of the concept. So for concepts, for muskolos, we use the value system of true and false. And for the fusomos, for appearances, we use the value system. Pleasant or unpleasant, attractive or unattractive, or good and bad. That being the case, Rambam says it's important to understand that Odom HaRishon before the case was perfect in his intellect. The human being has never achieved such perfection, such intellectual perfection, as Odom HaRishon achieved before the case. What about after the chet? This is where the difference is. Before the chet, his intellectual perfection was in the area of concept. In the value system of emes and shekel, true and false. That was where his brilliance was. That doesn't mean that he didn't also have taste. That doesn't mean that he couldn't take a bite of an apple and say, delicious. I enjoy it. He had the mefusamos as well, he had the appearances as well, of course. But his mind was so clear in the area of the mefusamos, in the area of concept, that dominated his whole being. We gave the example last night of assuming that the door of a microwave oven could be opened without turning the microwave off, and assuming that you come home after a long day's work terribly, terribly hungry, and you're a little bit earlier than you expected, and so the food is still in the microwave. You come into the kitchen and you smell this most delicious smell, absolutely wonderful, and your mouth starts watering, and you feel you're about to pass out. And you come to the kitchen to see where the smell is coming from, and you see this gorgeous looking food, laid out so beautifully and just ready, sizzling away in the microwave oven. And you say to your wife, how long is it still going to be? And she says, about 45 minutes. Like it's a microwave oven. You can't take 45 minutes. You can't take it. If one were to say that the shear is only going to start in 45 minutes, we say, good, that gives me time to do something during the shear. So you begin to say, supper's only in 45 minutes. How am I going to survive for 45 minutes? Being so hungry and being so famished and being exposed to this gorgeous smell. Would you consider opening the microwave oven door and putting your hand inside? Mm-hmm. No person would. you know the danger. Despite the power of one's passion and the pangs of one's anger, there is no thought, it doesn't enter one's mind as a possibility, that I might put my hand inside those microwaves and damage myself in order to take it through. That wouldn't happen. Why not? Anger. People would misfocus. I understand the concept of the microwave. You can't see them. Not a little song, there's no apparent. An idiot would say there, take it out, put your hand in and take it out. Take a taste at least, it will make you feel better while you're waiting. Take put my hand in there, you're out of your mind. You know what will happen if I put my hand in there? You understand? Where there is clarity of understanding of concepts, there's no yet over. There's nothing yet over that means. A moth flies into a candle. Yeah, if it doesn't have the story, the candle is beautiful, it's attractive, it's warm, it's light. Flies in. A human being doesn't. He doesn't fly into a fire. No matter how cold he might be, he can be dying of cold. Provide him with a fire, he won't jump into it. Why not? The story is, he understands what fire is. He understands it's dangerous. And yet, it's gone. Although Maharishi's brilliance was in the area of mistrolis. Once one's operating in the area of mistrolis, the area of concepts, then the area of apparences becomes very irrelevant. You now don't eat what tastes good. You eat what you need. You eat what's healthy. You understand mistrolis, you're working with concepts. Why am I eating? I'm eating for health. If that's the case, I'm going to eat what's good. If it also tastes nice, very nice, that's wonderful. I'll make a broken, I'll thank the Rebbe Shalom, and I'll appreciate the good taste. But I'm not going to choose my food on the basis of the taste. That becomes so unimportant and so irrelevant. But to an ordinary person whose understanding of concepts is lacking, the taste becomes more important than the health. After the hate, yes, perhaps important to look at the words of the Rambam inside. This feeling was so strong, says the Rambam, by the way, that even walking around naked did not seem in any way wrong to Oda Marisha and Tukhari. Because the words MS and Sheker don't apply to that. There's nothing untrue about walking about naked. That's how the human being was created. There's nothing to be ashamed of. Matters of taste, it doesn't look nice, it's not good. That they hadn't developed it. That was relatively undeveloped. The main area of their power was in the scholars, and in the scholars there's nothing wrong with walking around naked. The Hashem Mora Vanota El Tavis of Hadiyamis, the Hanois Kushol Hagashmis, however, when he rebelled and deviated after his apparent desires and physical pleasures. And what point was that? Not at the point where he ate from the tree. Before that, the Moshe Omar says in the Chumash, "He toivo et lemaichel v'hi toivo hu leinayim." They observed that the tree was good for food, and it was delicious for the eyes, and it was pleasing to the eyes. Noticing that and being impressed by that, at that moment they had already opted for a line of action, not based on the scholars. In terms of the scholars, that's irrelevant if it looks good. It makes no difference what it looks like. You've got to choose to eat what's healthy, not what looks pleasant and what looks attractive. And this tree is unhealthy for you to eat. It's because there's a tzibri, there's a mitzvah not to eat from it. That's the only mitzvah you've got. Even noticing the beauty and the attractiveness of it shows the tendency to follow the mufusomas, the appearances, to notice the appearances, and to place some value on the appearances. At that point, Ne'enash, already there he was punished. At that moment, the Sheshulau HaHasogo HaHi HaSif, in that his intellectual brilliance became impaired. His intellectual brilliance became damaged at that moment. That, by the way, didn't only happen once. That happens to every human being. The degree of one's intellectual brilliance is inversely proportional at any given moment to the extent that one is places value and weight on the mufusomis, on the appearances of life. One is able to increase one's intellectual capacity as one decreases one's involvement in appearances. ומפני זה מורו במצווה אשר בעבור סליח לו ציבובו. And as a result of that, he rebelled against the one and only mitzvah which he was instructed because of his superior intellect. V'higia loy ha-todois ha-mefusonis. And as a result of that, he achieved competence in the area of a parent. You cannot appreciate appearances when you're involved in reality. You cannot appreciate appearances when your mind sees with absolute clarity. It sees the miscolors, the conceptual world. Only when there's a lack in your intellectual perception, only when you cannot see emes v'sheker, truth and falsehood, with absolute clarity, then other things start playing more and more of a role, more and more of a part. And for the first time, Odom HaRishon is able to really understand and appreciate the mifusomes, the characters. That was the Rambam. What is it? After last night's shiur, Leonard Golden observed that it seems to emerge from this that in order to persuade people, or to certainly to mislead them, a person has to be involved in the area of mefusomes, not miskolos. The Ribbono Shel Olam only became worried that Odom would mislead the world after he did it from the past. When you're dealing in the conceptual world, you can't persuade anybody anything. You can either convince a person or you don't convince a person. When you're dealing with emes and sheker, when you're dealing with absolute systems, you can either prove something to somebody or you can't prove it to somebody. If you've proved it to them, you've convinced them. If you haven't proved it, you agree to differ. That's all. Or he'll prove to you that you're wrong. When you're dealing in emes and sheker, there's no place for persuasion. You can't persuade a person to do that. You either prove that you're right or you can't prove that you're right. That's it. But when you're dealing in the area of mefusomes, when you're dealing in the area of parity, where everybody sees something a little bit differently and people's attitudes are colored by their own personalities, there is it possible to persuade somebody that something is nice and attractive, even if it isn't necessary. Let's understand how. Interesting, you have often observed, never understood really until recently, why many of the, practically all, of the old Bikdashi yeshivas always struggled for money. Money was always a bank. They never had beautiful buildings. And to this day it's the case. Never had beautiful buildings, never had enough. Always a battle, always a struggle. And yet you'll hear universities are the most beautiful of buildings, and hundreds of thousands of rand given for this and given for that. How do you persuade a benefactor to give money to a yeshiva? Whether it's 1,000 rand or 2,000, how do you persuade him to give 500,000 rand to a yeshiva? Half a million rand, something like that. So if he's a Ben Torah, no problem. All he has to believe is that he has some kind of connection with the yeshiva and he understands the value of Torah. You can prove him, you don't have to persuade him. You can work, you're working with miskolos, you're working with concepts, you're working with emes and shek. You go through with him. What is the function of your money? How much do you really need? What could be done with it? Can you think of anything greater to do with it? So you can work with him. But it's not that often that one finds an Eitoda with 500,000 rand to spend. So one has to go or consider going to people who are not an Eitoda. And what does one say to them? Start with some scholars. Start with concepts of illness and shekin. What are you talking about? Start explaining to them what Torah is, the value of Torah, and what's worth more and what's worth less. And they understand he's not operating in the world of the scholars. He's operating in the world of the scholars. He's operating in the world of the parents. And you come and talk to him about MSP Shilton, there's no way you can understand it. You're using completely different values. It's like one person saying to another, what's the distance from here to, the distance from here to Pretoria? And the other person answers 35 degrees centigrade. What's the communication? We're doing two different systems of evaluation. You're talking about temperature and I'm talking about distance. I'm talking about Mithil Somers, and you're talking about Mishkolos. I'm talking about appearances, and you're talking about reality. You use the terms of Emes V'Sheker, I use the terms of Tevera. What are we talking about? There's no common language. So I have to use a pen. I've got to make it appear good for him. That's really quite difficult. There are different ways I can do it. I can learn a piece of Rashi and show him how beautiful it is. That's where I'm likely to get 500 if I do it yet. But I want to get 500,000. How is it going to be done? There's only one way to do it. And that's the way which the Al-Gadol in Israel has never done. That is, you have a big party in the issue. And you invite him to be the guest of honor. And you put this miserable wretch at the main table, and the Halas Shabbos, and the Bechon, and the Velus, and the Kripus, and the Babel, Lashon Hora, real nobody. All he does is he happens to have a 500,000 rand. Or more, he happens to have a 500,000 rand to spare. And you put him up at the top table, and you bring a lechaim to him, and you make a toast to him, and you refer to him, and you show him aleichem, and you take him on a tour. All of a sudden, Torah feels good. What have you done? It's honest. You're using the skills of salesmanship to sell him something which is genuinely good and to make it feel good for him. Some argue that feeling the goodness of Torah is good. Others argue that it's dishonest. It can't be. And it's possibly for that reason that many of our Gedolei Yisrael have refused to take money from people who don't appreciate them. Not at all, no matter how much money they need and how much money the other is worth, they're not prepared to take. This might be part of the reason, because the way of getting it involves an aspect of salesmanship which isn't spoken, which isn't honest. What about true salesmanship? How does advertising work? So you take a population and you make them feel that Coca-Cola is better than PepsiCo. If you would tell them the MS, you would find there's no difference. If you can't tell them the MS, if you're dealing with Muslim, with Muslim, with scholars, if you would be dealing with context, you would find that the differences are so minute that only the most sophisticated and delicate of palates would be able to tell the difference. But the average American offering his hamburgers and all the rest of the meat is together with his Coca-Cola is quite incapable of telling the difference between Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola. But you can't tell him that. Otherwise one of the two companies is going to go bankrupt. So you've got to work with Mr. Sommers. You've got to make him see things which aren't really there. Make him take a liking to it. How do you do it? You build an image. You build an image by the label you design, by the type of advert, the type of people that you showed eating Coke, drinking Coke, and the type of people that you showed drinking Pepsi, so that he'll identify with this one and he'll identify with this one. They do the same with cigarettes. Tell people the truth about cigarettes, you're not going to sell a single box. You're going to mislead them. You've got to tell them not the truth, only with little solace. If you're going to deal with the scholars, what you've got to do is the advert would be something like this. You'd see a doctor getting up onto the screen and discussing the concept of cancer and the relationship between smoking and cancer. That would be the, if he was going to use MS. They don't do so, they use little sonnets. Apparently, a beautiful bath, it's covered nicely, and people enjoying themselves, making all little sonnets. And people are attracted to little sonnets, not mistakes. People's lives are based on apparently, not on reality. And that's the way the advertising industry makes a living. Is there such a thing as kosher little sonnets? Surely. A child needs to eat their food. How do you get that the child doesn't want to eat? And put a bit of sugar inside and let the child taste a little bit, it tastes nice, tastes sweet. You're feeding the child. If you're feeding the child using Mithusomers to bring him closer to Mithusomers, to bring him closer to the reality, he can't understand, he's incapable of understanding the Mithusomers. So you're using the appearances in order to achieve the result as if he could understand the Mithusomers. That's what we do. We go back to our benefactor and I say, how can we use the same concept for him? Sure we can. If I want to get him to learn Torah, I can use Mithusomers. I can take a little bit of Torah and present it in such a way and make it exciting and build it up and put a little story around it and make it sound nice and exciting, but even though he doesn't come from the world of the intellect, he's just an ordinary businessman, nevertheless, he can understand, he can appreciate the beauty of it. And as a result of that, he'll say, I want to come tomorrow as well. Fine, I have to tell him another story tomorrow. We do exactly what we do with a child with the medicine, or the child with the food. We sweeten it, we make it nice, we make it exciting, we put a bit of flavoring into it, and that's fine. If you would just learn a Tosfos with him, if you would go through a difficult Tosfos and read and translate and get chatting Tosfos, he would say, look, this Torah business is not for me, I don't know what you're wasting your time on irrelevancies for. And you can have two people sitting, and one says, I don't know what you're wasting time on irrelevancies for, and another person is sitting there with Mesiris Nefes with great self-sacrifice because he considers there's nothing more important in the world than understanding the Tosfos. How does that happen? One is living in the world of Mitzvot, one is living in the world of concepts, of Emes and Shekel, and the other is living in the world of Mitzvot, and he can't taste the Tosfos. It doesn't have a wrapping. It doesn't come in a box. He doesn't understand what it is. So there is such a thing as presentation. There is such a thing as presenting something true in a tasty way. As long as Odom HaRishon was involved in the scholars, primarily and almost exclusively, not only would he have no interest in persuading the world that he was God, but he wouldn't be able to do. That's what we're taking further over last night. Last night we put it across that he wouldn't have the interest. He's involved in Emes. What's he going to do to persuade the world that he's a God? Maybe he is. He also had some form of Yetzer Hara. There was some kind of intellectual concept of Yetzer Hara. Maybe an individual couldn't have such a tendency. It wasn't somebody as great as Odom HaRishon. What we're saying now is that even if he had the tendency, he wouldn't have the capacity. Because you can only persuade people with mefusholos. You can only persuade people with apparencies. You can't persuade them with concepts. People go to sleep when you call concepts, unless they're intellectual people. The only way you can get them excited and interested is with mefusholos. You've got to give them some sugar. To give them sugar. Other Malishan doesn't understand the need of sugar. Things are so clear to him. And he's so interested only in emes v'sheker. But this kind of thing of making the emes sweet as well, and he doesn't understand how much sweeter can it be than truth. And so there would be no communication in that sense between himself and the rest of the world. However, once he'd come down, and he was now on the level of understanding and appreciating and competent in the usage of the Tulsonis, now he's the reversion of the problem. If he presents himself as a nice person to the behemoth and the chayim, they might quite take him. And they might give him a lot of coverage, and especially when they see that he's eternal. One sees that very concept in democracies today. And in the way elections are run, and elections are fought, and elections are won, on the basis of this story. Nobody wants a leader who's going to do MS, but that might hurt. If he's really going to bring down inflation, then maybe living standards are going to be brought down too. So no leader told you before that that's what he's going to do. As soon as I come in, this is going to go up, and that's going to go up, and this is going to become harder, and that's going to become harder, because that's the right thing to do, to lose the election. So he smiles, and he plays with the babies, and he tells jokes, and that's how he gets elected. And one can understand, conceptually, how it is today that a film star becomes a president, and jolly good one too. We're dealing with mefusholos, we're dealing with apparencies, and there's no greater apparency than Hollywood. That's where one's taught the skills of the usage of apparencies. And the fact that television plays such an important part in life today, and television is mefusholos, television is not mefusholos, it's an image, that's all. And it's the image which is sold, and it's the image which is bought, and it's the image in which a confidence is built. It's not mefusholos. You don't know a thing about the person who's behind the screen. He's prepared, and he's primed, and makeup is put on his face. You can't tell his age. You can't tell his state of mind. You can't tell his mood. Nothing. It's all a big farce. It's all a dresser. It's all to fool you. He can be miserable and depressed and terribly worried, and he comes on looking relaxed, and he's in his garden and sun all day, and he's got a little joke to tell, and you've been fooled, because you're dealing with mefusholos, you're dealing with what you've been shown, not dealing with the honest, not dealing with the true facts. The true facts were shown. The world would be very different. You're not capable of handling the true facts. Torah, the greatest challenge today is to move away from the personas and to move into the area of mistakes. To move away from apparencies and to move towards concepts. The first area that has to be done is in the intellectual area itself, where there's a tremendous tendency to be attracted after the way things appear to be rather than the way they really are. And the difficulty in developing the skills of learning to understand what is it saying, not what would I like it to say, or what do I think it says, or what do I believe it says, but what does it say, is a difficult, hard self-discipline which is acquired over years and years and years of endless concentration and questioning and analysis and deep thought, to be able to get below the mufusamas right down to the muskolas, to get below the apparences down to the depth of the essence of it. That's the skill that has to be developed purely in the learning skill set, which is something which is not often taught. And also in the running of one's life. But as one becomes more involved in perceiving things as they really are rather than they appear to be, so one's life, the emphasis on one's life starts changing. One becomes less impressed by the mufusamas, less attracted to the mufusamas, less taken for a ride by the mufusamas. One starts seeing through things a little bit. One starts seeing the emes, one starts seeing things in their true light. Very dangerous is the tendency to use mufusamas exclusively as a way of understanding and teaching. So it's all very well if you understand the piece of Gemara thoroughly, with the scholars, you understand the concept, you understand the emes, and you choose in order to explain it to an amhore, to somebody that's not involved in these things. So you choose to explain it in a way which is mufusamas. You choose to use the sugar-coated method to explain it. That's one thing. But when you yourself don't understand the mufusamas, you only heard it with the sugar coating, you're already telling others to passing it on with the sugar coating as well. All you're doing is selling sugar. You don't understand what's beneath it. It might be a dangerous tablet that's beneath it. You have no clue what's underneath it. You've got sugar, so you're passing it on to somebody else. Like a kid that gets hold of a tablet, which his mother gave him because he's sitting in the bed, and he passes the drugs out to all his friends at school. My mother said it's good, and it does taste good. So he gets hold of the bottle and he passes them out. He doesn't understand. That's the danger of communication without mistakes. At least the communicator, at least the teacher, has to understand the mistakes. I told you the story once of the time of the virtue before. Pesach was in a terrible state. The matzahs had arrived and they were all broken. We couldn't find two complete matzahs. We couldn't find two whole matzahs. So he passed them, but under the circumstances there was no time to get any more, to bake any more. Under the circumstances, if they could reconstruct a complete matzah, they could use that, even if they weren't able to, even if they couldn't hold it as one piece, if they could lay it on the table like a jigsaw puzzle, reconstructed in its complete form, and they could use that. So he got his sons and the shamans and two other people to sit and start putting the pieces together. So the Gobel, the Biskarov was there, and his brothers, various other people, and they sit there. And the Biskarov was sitting with his brothers trying to put the pieces together. He was one of the greatest minds of the century, working on piecing this puzzle together. And after hours and hours and hours, he's got one matzah. He's got one matzah. He looks up for the first time and he sees the shamas has already got a pile of them. My goodness, is this how? Did you do that? It's very simple. Come, I'll show you. Look, you take this piece and this piece. They don't put together. So you break up a little piece there and you break up a little piece there and you put it together. Also, the distance of that's the distance between our system of learning and other people's system of learning. We don't break pieces off to make it fit. It doesn't fit with either. We don't break pieces off to make it fit. That's the difference whether you're working with mufusamas or you're working with mufusamas. If you're working with apparencies, you decide the attitude and you make the apparency fit you. That's the danger of apparency. That you see the world the way you want to see the world, not the way it is, because in any case you're only looking at apparencies. And if it's beautiful to you, if you want it to be beautiful, it will be beautiful. That's all there is to it. If you like it, you will like it. If it's tasty to you, it will be tasty and good. You don't care what it really is or what other people find it. What's important is the attitude you have decided to adopt. And then you break the pieces to make it fit. Not so when you're dealing with the scholars. When you're dealing with the scholars, you're dealing with objective standards. Is it true or isn't it? That's all I want to know. I'm not interested in what my attitude is. Once I've discovered it is true, I will adapt my attitude to the truth. Not adapt the truth to my attitude. And if it's sheker, if it is false, I will adapt my attitude to that. Not I will adopt the falsehood to what I want it to be. That is why we always say continuously weary of non-intellectual learning. And using the word intellectual in a Torah sense, not only superficial or pseudo sense. Learning without deep, deep thought, without deep analysis and without deep concentration. Because that learning is learning as little summits. You're learning apparencies, you're not learning the end. And the tendency when you're learning apparencies is to make it what you want it to say, to make it what you want it to be, to adapt it to your attitude, not to adapt your attitude to it. It's much too hard. It takes much too long to do that. The lazy way to do it is to take your own decisions first, and then to see the effect in the light that you want to see it. Learning superficially, or even superficially, when one's learning non-intellectual, without thought, without depth, without applying the totality of one's mind to the understanding of what the principles are. Really, what are you playing around with? The Shamus is breaking the pieces of matter to make more. You finish the Masechta, good, I finish the Masechta. Do you understand the Masechta? No way. So what does the Masechta say? So you'll say, you'll explain to people what it says. Are you sure that that's what it says? Well, yes, look, so what does it mean? And then you'll take the person, you'll start analyzing. If that's what it says, then how can that be so? And what does this mean? And what does that mean? Difficult. Think of that. So what have you been doing? You've been taking the little pieces of matter and breaking them up to make them fit. And that you don't do. That's dealing in the world of mistakes, of mafusomis, not in the world of mistakes. And so this tendency to deal with apparently creeps right into Jewish life and into religious Jewish life and into total learning, and has to be guarded against terribly tested. Same applies in interpersonal relations. The importance of seeing people for what they really are, not for what they tell themselves to be. Terribly difficult in that area that all the great decisions of human relations are made and all the bad decisions of human relations are made. Everyone sells themselves as tzaddikim. Everybody sells themselves as good and kind people and clever people. For one's own protection, what one has to develop the skills to do is to see the mistakes. What is he really? Not what does he appear to be. I'm not interested in what he appears to be. I'm interested in what he is. And that's very difficult. The Torah then immediately goes on to show the consequences of the faith. And here we have the tragedy of the human situation. In the story of Cain and Hevel. And we'll see the problems created by the confusion resultant in a diminished sefer, a diminished intellect, and the tendency to see things on the surface. One of the problems in learning Torah, particularly these parshas, is that when we were children, we were taught these parshas as mefusomos. We were taught them as apparently. Because we were too small to understand the mistakes, we were too small to understand the deep meaning and analysis of them. And being as we've remained children, we still understand these parshas in the same way. Chayim and Hevel, who were they? Gedolei Olam. Can you imagine children of Hogan and Chavah? Talk to such depths, talk about how the Israelis were. Talk about the Gedolei and Chayim, so we'll educate them a few moments ago. In the Gedolei. The Rambam, the Rambam, the Bati Amiroyim, the Tanoim, the Ovis, and Cain and Hevel we talk about last year, the neighbor down the road. Cain and Hevel, great people. And their argument was not simply jealousy, it wouldn't have been recorded in the Torah at the time. Their argument was a machloikis, the machloikis, Cain and Hevel. And just as when there's a machloikis, Abaya v'Rova, we break our heads to understand what the machloikis is all about. And when there's a machloikis, Rashi and Tosfos, we break our heads to understand what the machloikis is all about. So with Cain and Abel, let's understand what was their argument about, what was their difference of opinion about. And this is a very beautiful issue. Ikrim says the following. Hevel brings the second. Cain first. Vayove Cain v'kriva Adomo min kol Hashem. Cain brings a sacrifice, vegetables from the ground. That's so terrible. He's a farmer. He's just been told, but Cain hoyo oved Adomo. Cain worked the land. And he wants to express his gratitude to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because it brings the fruits of his labor to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Very nice. What's wrong? And Hevel, he's a cattle tender. He was a raid soil, he was a shepherd. So the heavenly began who did the first soil in the Chavain, he brought to the firstborn of his flock and fat one. By Yisha Hashem el Hevel vel min chosu vel kain vel min chosu lo isho. And the Ribbono Shel Olam listened to Hevel and to his sacrifice and not to Kain. Ask him, what was the terrible thing that Kain did? So long, the Ribbono Shel Olam refused his sacrifice. Says the Yitri, Cain believed that man and animal are on the same level. Both eat vegetables. Both are animals, not vegetables, and therefore the vegetable world is subject to death. But man and animal are not different species. In fact, people think that Darwin was the first Darwinian, they're wrong. Cain was the first Darwinian. He held that man was a type of animal. He was a superior type of animal, that's all, a more a further evolved animal. And he looked at the animals, and he saw the evolution, he saw the very simple and the very basic animals, and he saw the clever animals, and he worked his way up, and he saw the monkeys and the apes and the rat animals and all the rest of them, and he decided that human beings is a superior animal. And therefore we're certainly the same as we can't eat each other, we can't eat animals. And just as we can't kill one another, we can't kill animals. That's why the evolution doesn't allow the eating of meat. What are we allowed to eat? Vegetables, the same as the animal. So when he wants to bring a sacrifice, he brings vegetables, the same as the animal. He missed one point of this, and that is that the preferred human food is vegetables that contain seeds, particularly fruit. That was specifically what the Ribbono Shel Olam gave to Adam HaRishon. The tree Eitz Hagan, from the fruit of the tree in the garden. Fruit and wheat. There's the seeds, all the both of them, the common denominator between uniquely human foods are that they contain seeds. The vegetables are ready for animal food. And he should have brought his sacrifice from fruit, but he didn't, he brought it from tree or Adam. Showing that he in fact did not appreciate that subtle difference, that although both human beings and animals eat vegetables, they eat different vegetables. Which indicates, in fact, human beings and animals are not the same species. But that he didn't pick up immediately. What's Hevel's view? Hevel also knows you can't kill animals at the stage, meat is forbidden. You can't eat animals. But, says the Ikrim, Hevel believed that it's the function of the human being to dominate animals, to tame animals, to master animals, to stand them in for man's use. We are superior animals, and therefore we may use the inferior animals. And where it's the Shem Shemayim, where it's for Avodas Hashem, where it's for a sacrifice, we're even allowed to kill the animal because we're using the animal that way for our service of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what Hevel believes. The Ribbono Shel Olam accepts Hevel's sacrifice and not Cain. Says Cain to himself. Obviously, Hevel is right. We are allowed to kill animals. And since I believe that human beings are just other kinds of animals, if Hevel is getting in my way, just as to further his service of God, he kills these lambs. So if Hevel is getting in the way of my service of God, I can kill Hevel. That will be the sacrifice. Why not? He brought from the best of his lambs. Let me bring my younger brother, the best. There's no lamb better than that. And since he is in the way of my avodas Hashem, and therefore Cain sees absolutely no immorality in the murder of another human being, once he sees that the murder of animals is sin. The fundamental mistake being he's not seeing the difference between man and animal. Not seeing the difference. Of course he saw the difference. But seeing man merely as a superior animal, not as a different species altogether. And so he kills him. The Ikrim says that the philosophy of Cain flourished until the time of the flood and was the underlying cause of that whole generation of the flood. once you see man as superior animals, then your basic principle of interpersonal behavior is the law of the jungle, called the Alim Dvar, survival of the fittest, which is exactly what Darwin says. That's the way the world functions. Once you see no distinction between man and animal, then you see the survival of the fittest as being the basic principle which governs mankind. And the logical consequence of that is the destruction, the degeneracy, the immorality and decadence that existed before the time of the flood. What you see here is an amazing thing happening, a terrible tragedy. Two people, both mistaken, Abel was also mistaken, but to a lesser degree than Cain, and that's why, says the Ikrim, Abel was punished, Abel died. Why wasn't he saved if he was a tzaddik? So you see that he was also wrong. Both didn't fully appreciate the degree to which man was different and man was separate. And because of the way they interpreted things, they interpreted the law that you shouldn't kill animals, they interpreted the evolutionary development of the human being, they thought that the way the world looks to them, they built a philosophy on little solace and the way things appeared. It was all very nice, except the philosophy happened to be wrong. And as a result of that, a quarter of the world population was wiped out. And another quarter of the world's population was cursed and was destined to a life of misery and perpetual toil and trouble as a result of a mistake. Based not on bad logic, the logic's very good, the logic can't be faulted. The original assumptions are wrong, the premises are wrong. And why are they wrong? Because I'm looking at what's in front of me. I'm not looking at Emerson Schaeffer, I'm not looking at misspoken. And here we see the tragedy of an individual left to the devices of his own intellect. As wonderful as his intellect is, as sharp and as straight as it is, what's he starting with? Logic only works to get you from A to B. Logic doesn't give you A. That's why in mathematics you've got to start with axioms. You can't start with nothing. Logic does not have the ability to give you the starting point. Logic can only take you from the starting point to the second point. What do you use as your starting point? Now you have a choice. You scholars or little science. You can look around and see what things appear to be and build your axioms on that. Or you can work in the field of your scholars of concepts, of tennis and of shape. Where do you do that? Either from truth, either from facts, or from trusting. From trust, another person tells you, this is the end. Either you're convinced that it's the MS, or you trust the person who's telling you. That's the Surah. We get it from our Rabbein, we get it from the previous generation. That's where we know what the Muslim is. But to take Cain and Hevel and start them off and say, right, you're on your own, here's the world, you have the most brilliant mind, you have sharp, straight intellect, work it all out, work out the system of morality. That's what chance you have. Look around and they start with incorrect premises. And they wipe each other out. It's so interesting to note how this pattern has repeated itself over and over again in history. You will inevitably find kindness to animals, excessive kindness to animals, as a precursor to human viciousness. The over-concern with the welfare of animals, animal morality, is the basis of human immorality. That's where it all starts. Because a person who starts treating an animal as a human being, his next step is treating human beings like animals. It has to be that. The Nazis were known for their love of animals. Couldn't see. Hitler couldn't tolerate to see an animal in pain. Of course he could. Didn't like seeing human beings in pain either. But sometimes, for the good of the species, I've got to wipe out a few animals. I don't want to be present when it's done, but I don't mind instructing the vet to do it. And it makes no difference if the object of the vet is an animal, or the object of the vet is a human being, is also an animal. That doesn't matter. It has to be done. The moment while we regard this obsessive kindness to animals as being a great moral level, oh no. When the world was nearly destroyed at the time of the flood, what was the tikkun? What was the correction that the Ribbono Shel Olam gives mankind to make sure that it doesn't have it happen again? Kol remes asher hu chai, every living creature, lochem yiyeh le'ochlo, is for you to eat. Keyerek Esev Nasati Lochem Eskoil. I've given it to you, says the Torah, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, like the green of the grass. You thought that only vegetables are to be eaten. Eat the animals so that you know that they are there for your service, and so that you know you're not an animal. And a human being, and an animal is not a human being. An animal is food, that's what he is. There are halachas that govern the way you treat an animal. There are halachas that govern the way you kill an animal. But that's to preserve your humanity, not to preserve the animal's life. You need to understand that that's what's paramount. Your humanity, not the animal's life. There's a difference, there's a basic incompatibility between animal and human being. The one is not an evolution from the other. The one is a completely different breed. And just as animal eats vegetables, so man eats animal. And that's laid down after the flood so that it should never happen again. So all the laws are introduced, restricting which animals can be eaten and which animals can't. But as a moral principle, we're instructed to eat animals. That is the basis of morality. Without that, there cannot be human morality. Somebody says that I'm like I have no time with it. I can't argue against it. If you get vegetarians who build a religion out of it, it's a religion of moral decadence. It's a religion based on an inability to distinguish between man and animal, to have the same emotions towards an animal that one has towards man. And that's the foundation of destruction, that's the foundation of decadence, and that's the foundation of degeneracy. Even from these desires of meat once a week on Shabbos, just to show that I believe that animals are there to serve human beings and they're not there to do the same as humans. That's all one needs. An act of demonstration. One doesn't have to eat meat to satisfy one's stomach. One doesn't have to eat meat to fool oneself. One needs to eat meat as a fulfillment of a moral injunction to remember and to believe and to know the animal world is there to serve the human world. Isn't it amazing? And when one looks at the scholars, at the mitzvah psalmist, one can take something that appears so moral, kindness to animals. In America today, not only do they have dog parlors, they have therapy, and they have for a long time, but they've got dog psychiatrists, and dog psychologists, and dog babysitters, and dog hospitals, and dog hotels, and dog nursery schools, the whole thing they've got for them. What's that based on? One has to know that when you see that in a society, it's a dangerous sign. That's the beginning of a Holocaust, Chassid Shalom. When one sees a society become obsessed with kindness to animals, it's a time to emigrate. This is not a time for South African Jews to go to America. It's a time for American Jews to come to South Africa. It's a time to be scared. That's Mufusomis. That's creating a philosophy, creating a morality on the basis of what it appears to me. I am the big balabos. I know what's right and what's wrong. I choose the system of morality. How does the Ribbono Shel Olam say about Adam when he gets so worried that he's going to mislead the world? And we pointed out the Talmud Unkelus. Adam is unique in the world. It is now within himself to establish a moral system, to decide what is good and what is bad. Up till now it's been objective, it's been guided by truth. Now he'll make decisions of what is right and what is wrong, and who knows what it will lead to. It will lead to vegetarians, it will lead to kindness to animals, and it will lead to doggy hospitals and doggy psychiatrists and to 6 million Jews being killed. That's what it will lead to. He'll decide, that's moral. Exactly what happens. Cain and him. Cain decides there's no difference between man and animal. We're just superior animals, and if you can't kill animals, you can't kill human beings. And it seems that you can kill animals under certain circumstances, so you can kill human beings as well. That's a logical deduction, a logical consequence. That's the challenge of Torah. The challenge of Torah is not just to learn a new din and to start keeping a new din. The challenge of Torah is not just to become more frum in terms of mufusamis, to appear more frum. The challenge of Torah is to become more frum in terms of muskolis, to become a greater person, to become a better person. The challenge of Yiddishkeit, Torah, is in a world of superficiality, where even intellect has been turned into superficiality, where even intellect has been turned into a marketable item, into merely matters of presentation, formulas. Look at a lot of the books that are written today. It's techniques, not principles. They're how-to books. How to do this, how to do that, how to be a good parent, how to become a millionaire. Not an analysis of what parenthood is. What is the relationship, how PM is. What is the true relationship between parent and child, child and parent. One time books on that. Nobody cares, nobody knows, all they want to know is how to appear like a good parent. How to do the monkey tricks, which make you go through the motions of good parenting. That's what people want to learn. How to become a millionaire. Not what are the essences of business, and what are the foundations of business, and what is business founded. Take you through a course of an understanding of the principles. No. A little paperback with 400 pages, how to become a millionaire. It was so easy there would be more around. It was a little solace, a matter of appearances, of marketing. How to be successful in this, how to be successful in that. It's a tendency to opt out of anything serious, anything demanding intellectually, and to take the shortest cut possible to achieve the apparency of results. That's all we're interested in. And if there's an apparency of results, everything is in order, everything is good. And so I feel it's becoming a total world. One looks at the modern stories that are printed in Paris. Look into a modern bookshop, what does one see? All the how-to books. How to keep kosher, how to slightly more sophisticated titles. How to table tailin, how to kasher tailin, how to daven, how to make tailin, all the how-to books. How to go through the motions of appearing to be a good Jew without having a clue of what it's all about. That's what it all is. So how to do it? There is no shortcut. One needs to know the dinim, sure, one needs to know the dinim. While one knows the dinim and one's expanding one's knowledge of the dinim, one needs to be developing an understanding of what the scholars, an understanding of the realities, of the concepts, of the emes v'sheker in the world. That's what one needs to understand. The yesodas, the principles on which the Torah is structured, on which the Torah is based. That's how one begins to understand. Then you don't need to read the how-to books anymore. Once you know the principles, you know the how-to automatically, instinctively. That takes time. It takes tremendous effort. Not so much effort in terms of how long I'm spending. In terms of the 5 minutes I'm spending learning, how I learn during that 5 minutes. The 10 minutes I'm reading a newspaper article, how I read that article. The 15 minutes that I'm watching a program on the television, how I watch it, how I understand it, how I analyze it. It's a question of concentration. It's a question of thinking. It's a question of using that mind and using that brain which the Rebbeinu Shlomo is giving. I'm not running through our lives like monkeys, sitting completely disinvolved and uninvolved, watching only with our eyes, hearing only with our ears, touching only with our fingers, without thinking, without analyzing, without understanding. It's such a disease, it's such a matter. And what does it lead to? Distortion, untruth, marketing, and marketing of untruth. That's what it leads to. The inability to detect untruth, the inability to detect something that's wrong. And as a result of that, you can have grobkeit, you can have coarseness marketed as Torah refinement, you can have lies marketed as Torah truth. Anything can be marketed. Once you've got the population not thinking, you can market what you like. That's what the Rebbeinu Shlomo was worried about. Adam, you're dealing with animals. And you know how to market now. Now you know the principles of the Pusamun. There is no end to what you can sell. You can sell a god, although it doesn't exist. You can make a god and sell it to people. When you're dealing with animals and you've got one person who understands the principles of Mufur Soled, a Hitler can sell a Holocaust to an entire nation of intelligent beings. All you have to do is stop them thinking. Doesn't matter how intelligent you are if you don't use what's on your shoulders. All you do is stop them thinking, regiment them, put them into an army sort of structure where decisions are made for them and not by them, and then sell them whatever you like. They'll buy it.
We're working in a world of animals. We can sell them a god, even if it's false. And that's where we are today. We're operating in a jungle. We're operating in a world nebuch of animals. People are not thinking. People are doing, they're living instinctively, they're living impulsively. Excuse me. They're living instinctively and impulsively. They're not people who're analyzing, they're not people who choose. That means they are totally nebuch, not they're weak. are totally in the hands of effective and skillful monks. And it is just easy game. If anything that's marketed well, we'll cut and we'll bite and we'll take and we don't have a chance. Skills of marketing are becoming more and more sophisticated. What I'm making is that marketing not only in the capitalist area of product outside, but also in the spiritual area of ideas, of policies, of principles, and of politics. The degree to which one's finding intelligent people today in South Africa saying unintelligent things, simply because they haven't thought it through, because they haven't been marketed to them, well marketed to them. Once you've got a person not thinking, you can market what you like to them. He'll buy it, he'll take it. That's our challenge. Our challenge is in a jungle, in a world of people who've been trained not to think, in a world of people who've been trained to do the tricks without understanding what they're doing, in a world where universities are technical colleges, they're not universities anymore, there are no more institutions of learning except a handful, little here and there, in secular learning, nothing in Torah learning, Baruch Hashem here and there, a little bit of pockets where there's still intellectual learning, where there's still thinking in the learning, where there's still understanding in the learning. But apart from that, we're living in a society which has been trained and regimented not to think, to accept. Our function is to fight against that, to understand the importance of thinking and analyzing, of making our own choices, of taking responsibility for our own choices, of finding pleasure in doing it.